I'm going to talk to you about private property. The title, you know, that you saw on the flyers is complicating private property. And when I say, like, I'm going to complicate something, what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of give us a sense of what the church says about private possession or private property. And then I'm going to open questions about it. This is how I approach subjects. It's how I do my research. I don't typically try to solve a problem or, you know, find a solution. I actually try to raise more questions about something because I think there are often certain things we just assume about that we know about things like private property and so on. So I'm going to move forward and give you, I hope, a little introduction into what we're doing. This is the outline of the discussion, just so you have a sense of where we're going, together. Feel free to interrupt me, by the way, if I say something too quickly or if you miss something or if you have a question about something I say, don't hesitate to interrupt me. I have six children. I'm used to being interrupted and trying to reclaim my train of thought. I'm going to start, as I said, with the church's teaching. I'm going to talk a little bit about what's baked into that teaching. The teaching, again, can seem kind of flat and one-dimensional to us, but there's a lot. This shouldn't be a surprise. There's a lot that's baked into it. It's a roughly 2,000-year process of developing thinking on this. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about property and the person, looking at Thomas Aquinas, since this is a Thomistic Institute thing. I'm actually not, like, I don't consider myself a scholar of Thomas Aquinas. I study Thomas Aquinas, but I study him, you know, much as I study other theologians or other philosophers that are in or engaged with the Catholic tradition over time. I'll talk a little bit about the Spanish intervention into this conversation, and then I'll just touch on, you know, a couple of sort of new issues, if any at all. Okay? All right. So, well, what the heck is that? Why care about property? I did not mean to do that. Okay, this is just, I love these kinds of quotations. This is a quotation from Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, you know, a kind of seminal text for the Western thinking about law and property. And I love the overstatement, and I just couldn't help myself from quoting it. There's nothing which so generally strikes the imagination, engages the affections of mankind, as the right to property, right? Nothing engages our imagination as much as the right to property, right? And then he points out nobody actually then explores it, right? There are plenty of things that engage our imagination more than the right to property, I hope, right? I hope that's true of you guys. I know it's true of me. So here's the catechism. Here's the state of Catholic teaching on private property. I think most of you guys know it or have a sense of it already. You'll say something like, oh yeah, the church affirms the right to private property. Actually, yesterday I was having a conversation in the halls of Caldwell Hall at Catholic University with a couple of colleagues. One of them is a canon lawyer, and he referred to the right to private property as inviolable, right? We have an inviolable right to private property. This is, I think, a kind of shorthand. We all more or less reflexively, I think that that's the case. But look at what this says in 2401, 2402, and 2403 of the Catechism. For the sake of the common good, it requires respect for the universal destination of goods and respect for the right of private property. There are two principles, or actually three principles, in that one sentence, right? One is the common good. One is this notion of the universal destination of all goods. And one is the one we're probably the most familiar with, even though common good language is reappearing. But the one we're most familiar with is this notion of the right to private property. Universal destination of goods, which comes first in this sentence after the notion of the common good, which is the ordering principle. For the common good, there are these two things, right? The universal destination of goods is this idea, an old idea in Christianity, that God intended everything for everyone, right? So the first notion is of God's intention, that everything is intended for all people. All goods are intended for all people. And then subsequent to that comes this conception of the right to private property. This is continued, this kind of chronological claim is continued in 2402. In the beginning, right, there's a chronology that's presupposed by that language. In the beginning, God entrusts the earth and its resources to the common stewardship of mankind to take care of them, master them by labor, and enjoy their fruits. Everything is understood in the beginning as common for all. Everybody will take care of them. Everybody will enjoy them. It's all shared by mankind. The goods of creation are destined for the whole human race. However, the earth is divided up, present tense, the earth is divided up. Another kind of chronological implication. That was the way it was. Now this is how things are. The earth is divided up among men to assure the security of their lives, endangered by poverty and threatened by violence. The appropriation of property is legitimate for guaranteeing the freedom and dignity of persons and for helping each of them to meet his basic needs and the needs of those in his charge. This distribution of property should allow for a natural solidarity to develop between men. The right to private property, again, they affirm the right to private property acquired or received in a just way, does not do away with the original gift of the earth to the whole of mankind. The universal destination of goods remains primordial, even if the promotion of the common good requires respect for the right to private property and its exercise. I don't know if you can see in there or not, but there's a tension in this dot, right, in these claims that are being presented to us as a developed teaching. This is the way the church understands the problem of private, the issue of private property, private possession. It somehow relates to the universal destination of all goods, which is chronologically prior, but also arguably, I would defend this argument, lexically prior. It has a kind of moral superiority to it, a moral priority to it vis-a-vis the right to private property, but nonetheless coincides with the right to private property. Here in this language, the earth is divided up to secure the security of their lives, etc. What do you hear baked into this? Security of their lives, insecurity, poverty, threats. There you hear more or less the language of the fall, right? The implications of the fall. So, arguably, and there is disagreement about this. When I say arguably, I'm shorthand for there is disagreement about this. Arguably, it's being suggested that the division of private property or the division into private possession that we now experience is a consequence of the fall. Okay, is a consequence of the fall. Some people will contend it's not. Some Thomists, in fact, contend it's not. Contend that private property would have existed, there would have been private possession even in an Edenic sense prior to a fall. Certainly those of us who are more Augustinian would probably lean towards this, but you could see that there is some tension, some claims built into this that we all have to wrestle with, and that the teaching itself has sort of appropriated over time. And then on top of this, right, 2403, where they reaffirm the right to private property. Okay, they reaffirm the right to private property. They say, nonetheless, this does not threaten the primordial quality of the universal destination of goods. Okay? So, I mean, I didn't say this to my colleagues at the time because I'm not really sure why. I was cowardly or just didn't want to talk to them. When he said that right to private property was inviolable, I wanted to say, nah, I don't know about that, right? I'm not so sure it's inviolable, okay? And we can discuss that in our conversation. So, Thomistic Institute time. Let's take a look at Thomas, right? We'll look a little bit at Thomas Aquinas on this question of ownership, question 66 of the Secunda Secundae, right? And I assume you guys have some sense of where this is coming from. Thomas Aquinas is Summa Theologiae, right? This is the second part of the second part, whether it's natural for man to possess external things. I'm just going to put a couple of of quotations from Thomas up there, and we'll talk about them. And then, you know, later in our questions, you guys feel free to ask questions about them. External things can be considered in two ways. First, as regards their nature. And this is not subject to the power of man. Right? So in the first sense of whether we can possess external things, where we can talk about external things according to their nature. This is not in our power, right? This is only in the power of God, right? But only in the power of God, whose mere will all things obey. Secondly, as regards their use, And in this way, man has a natural dominion, and that's the Latin there, over external things, because by his reason and will, he is able to use them for his own profit as they were made on his account. Okay, and Aquinas refers to Aristotle here to say this is the natural way by which human beings can be said to have a claim over external things, right? To possess external things. What is that way? Shorthand, use, right? A kind of use over them. We don't have ownership over them as regards their nature, right? Only in a in the sense of use. Okay? Is it lawful, he asks, for a man to possess a thing as his own? And I show the objection because I think it's important to understanding the response. It would seem it's unlawful for a man to possess a thing as his own, for whatever is contrary to the natural law is unlawful. According to the natural law, all things are common property, right? Think again, universal destination of goods. God's original intentionality for everything is that it be owned in common, be held in common, there for everybody's use, everybody's enjoyment. According to natural law, all things are common property. The possession of property is contrary to this community of goods. Therefore, it is unlawful for any man to appropriate any external thing to himself. That seems to follow, right? That's nice, tight, logical argument. Follows perhaps from some conception of the priority of the universal destination of goods. Thomas, you know, being very smart and also dealing with reality, right? Says there are, you know, he's got a response. Two things are competent to man in respect of exterior things. One is the power to procure and dispense them. And in this regard, it is lawful for man to possess property. Okay? The second thing that is competent to man with regard to external things is their use. On this respect, man ought to possess external things not as his own, but as common, so that, to wit, he is ready to communicate them to others in need. Okay, so we have the power, according to Thomas, to procure and dispense them, right? We have this kind of power over things. We can bring them into being by production, right? We can acquire them, you know, catch a deer in the forest or whatever, right? We can dispense of them. We can distribute them among ourselves. This kind of property ownership, according to this sort of first way of understanding something in terms of exterior things, that's appropriate to human beings. However, our ownership over them is not complete. It's not a full ownership over them. We have to own them as though they are common. So maybe we catch the deer, but now we have to understand our consumption of the deer, its distribution, and so on, as ordered towards the common and not merely towards us. Okay? Right? That's a limiting principle on ownership at that point. And again, if you want to ask any questions, don't hesitate to ask questions. What of common ownership? Okay, this is the same thing. Community of goods is ascribed, reply to objection one. This is the objection again, right? This is this first objection. What about what you just said about common ownership that seems to cut against it? He replies, the community of goods is ascribed to the natural law, right? Which he the first objection seems to say we're contradicting when we say we can order possess something in private. The community of goods is ascribed to the natural law, not that the natural law dictates that all things should be possessed in common and that nothing should be possessed as one's own, but because the division of possessions is not according to the natural law, but rather arose from human agreement, which belongs to positive law, as stated above in question 57, number 3 of the Secunda Secundae. Hence, the ownership of possessions is not contrary to the natural law, but an addition thereto devised by human reason. Do you understand that? Do you follow that? The community of goods is, in fact, ascribed to the natural law, he says, but this does not mean that we have to keep everything in common. It's not saying everything can't be divided up or procured and dispensed with in the way he just said they could be, right? That kind of dispensing and so on, that kind of distribution of property is not forbidden or prohibited by the natural law. Okay? It's not. It's added to it by the application of human reason, right, for certain good purposes, okay? And those good purposes are purposes we can talk about too, okay? That is an addition to the natural law, and there's nothing wrong, he claims, with adding certain things to the natural law so long as they are not prohibited. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Quick question about, in this case, the relationship between natural law and positive law. So when he says that it's an addition thereto devised by human reason, do you think he's saying in that case that this human agreement is sort of a necessary outcome of reason, or that it's something contingent based on the way society exists or evolves? Is that contrary to the natural law? It doesn't necessarily follow.
Yeah, if I understand right, I think in a way it's a kind of yes and no to the answer. So the fact that there is a distribution of goods in societies is probably a necessary consequence of, again, human sinfulness, of the fall. That the things are divided or distributed the way they are is not necessary, right? Do you understand the distinction I'm making? Right, because of the kinds of beings we are, going back to the threats to, you know, the insecurity, threats of violence, and so on, stability that's provided by, you know, saying this is mine, being able to wake up next morning and, you know, counting on your car being there, you know, not somebody not living in your house, right, who's a stranger and so on, right? Because of that, there has to be some kind of distribution. I think that that's probably necessary as a consequence of human sinfulness, but this or that way of doing it, that you own that and I own this, or the law protects this and that in those ways, I don't think is necessary. There can be different kinds of applications of human reason and so on. But this language of the addition to the natural law that is not offensive to the natural law is a critical part of the argument. Okay, and it's an argument he made earlier in question 94 of the Prima Secunda, where he asked whether the natural law can ever be changed. Is anybody familiar with his discussion on that, whether the natural law could ever be changed? It's a really famous discussion that Thomas has. I don't know if, Jennifer, you know that or not. In it, he asks, like, can the natural law be changed? And he says, of course, look, if by change you mean, can you subtract things from the natural law, right, prohibitions that we now say they no longer hold, right? The answer, of course, is clearly no. On the other hand, if you mean by changing the natural law additions to the natural law, he said, yes, there can be additions so long as they don't involve affronting or violating things that are prohibited or commanded by the natural law. And he gives us three examples. This is a really famous passage in one of his responses. The three examples he points to are the wearing of clothing, right? So by nature, right? I mean, it's awesome, right? By nature, we're naked. But human reason rightly responds to the situation of human beings and, right, says, okay, you know, it's in accordance with the natural law. This is a reasonable application of human intellect and choice to our current situation to recognize that wearing clothing is actually beneficial to the common good, right? It actually conduces to human sociality. So the wearing of clothing is one of them. Private property is another, right? Again, by the first intention of the natural law or the first order of the natural law, there's common possession, universal destination of goods, but it's right. It's a right application of reason to the situation to divide things up. The third, anybody know what the third one is? Gets really fun here, slavery. The third of these is slavery. The first condition, right, of human existence is the existence of freedom, where there's no mastery of one man over another man or one person over another person, right? But just as the wearing of clothing and the regime of private property is a kind of right application of reason to the situation of human beings in a fallen condition, so, he argues, is a situation of slavery. And there's a lot to be said there, right, a lot to open up about this, but I think it's really instructive that he connects those three things at that point as licit additions by human reason to the natural law. So let's, because of that, turn real quickly to Francisco de Vitoria. Vitoria writes in 1485, he was born in 1485, writes in 1532 his Relectio. It's basically a lecture that he gives, and his students take notes on it, and this is what we have is his students' notes. So when you take notes, it's very important that you take accurate notes, right? One day, you know, Capizzi's Lectio might be, you know, in your hands or something. 1532, this is shortly, right, 1492, Columbus sails the ocean blue, right? This is shortly after the Americas are discovered, and it's one of the most interesting intellectual moments in Western civilization. The Spanish theologians and philosophers start to ask themselves questions about the right by which Spain is now conquering and arguably dispossessing the native populations of their properties, right? So the phenomenon of property is a huge issue in the development of ideas in the West. It carries, you know, the way we think about punishment, it carries the way we think about war. This is literally an argument about whether the Spaniards have the right to wage war in order to dispossess the native populations of the Americas. Okay, they're there, as he points out, for this reason, to evangelize. The Spaniards are there. They all believe this. They're there to evangelize. They encounter these beings which nobody had experienced before. Vitoria never travels himself. He's in Spain, in Salamanca, for most of his life. He never gets the Americas, and they're reading these fantastic reports about what these people are like. They're reading about cannibalism and gold-paved streets and, you know, barbaric and debauched cultures, you know, regarding sexuality and human consumption and so on. Right, so he's getting all of this stuff secondhand from travelogues, essentially, and they have all of these issues. Right, well, what are we supposed to do with these guys? Can we wage war on them or not? Can we take their stuff? Can they be in possession of their stuff? Right, what is the right, he asks, by which the Native Americans the Native populations are subjected to the Spaniards? And the question becomes: Do the Indians actually have dominium rerum, right? Remember the Latin I used before, the dominium naturale, right? We have by nature a certain kind of dominion over things. The language of dominium is the key language here, and you should see, right, the connection of that to slavery, right? The language of dominium is the language of domination, of, right, the domus, the lord, right, the master over someone or something else. Do the Indians have this or not? It's a real issue. And he addresses certain kinds of categories of human beings or beings that might be presenting themselves to the Spaniards, by which you could say whether or not these guys actually have property rights. That's the issue. Do they have property rights? And he addresses all four, actually more than four of these, but I just singled out four of them to take a look at. One is the category of sinners, unbelievers, madmen, and insensati, right? The insensate. In other words, are these humans or not? And if they're humans, what kinds of humans are they? Because if they're the wrong kinds of humans, like an unbeliever or a sinner, you might say that their sinfulness undermines their ownership of a thing. If they're not human, right, either because they're mad, they don't have the operation of their reason, right, or they're insensate, right, they're kind of like some other kind of creature, then you might say they don't have dominion over anything at all, right? They have no property rights at all, and then they can be subordinated to us. Famously, some of you guys might know this, some Aristotelians, some Catholic theologians who were following Aristotle looked at the native populations and they said, here are the natural slaves that Aristotle was writing about. Right, that category of natural slavery that Aristotle discusses in the Politics and also in the Ethics, these are the guys. They're insensate. They need somebody else to be in control of them. They don't have the full operation of their reason. because they don't have full operation of the reason, they cannot be said to have dominium rerum. They don't actually have possession of things. Another category he looks at, of course, is children. Are they like children? Right, which is another argument that is used over and over in the justification for slavery throughout history. They're kind of like children. And children, some people would argue, don't have rights in things. Vittoria rejects that. Vittoria rejects the argument that both that they're like children and also that children can't have rights in things. He says children can actually own property. He's not convinced by these. Okay, he finds these completely unconvincing. All reports indicate these people have cities, they have governance, they have sophisticated militaries, right? They appear to have all of the kinds of things that appear to be operations of reason. These are the most difficult for him. Ultimately, he rejects those as well, right? The unbelievers thing he finds just to be a completely heretical conception. It's basically a Protestant conception of the way you would understand dominium, right? Because they're unbelievers, they can't be said to, they can't be said to have possession of things. It immediately sort of redounds to somebody who's a believer. He understands that to be a kind of Protestant claim. I'm not advancing that as an accurate claim, but that's Vittoria's concern, right? The sinner's one really bothers him the most, because according to him, he thinks there's a way in which he thinks if you are arguing that because they are sinners, they can't own, this undermines their natural dominion. This claim about their civil dominion, that they actually do or do not own these things, actually bleeds back into the way we understand natural dominion to operate. And because we're all sinful, right, it actually undermines any of our claims to these kinds of things. Okay, so this is a critical moment in the development, not merely of the way the West will think about property type claims and the justifications of war that are associated with property claims so often. It's also a moment at which you see international rights beginning to get sort of to come into being. Okay, that's an argument I make in another lecture or paper, but this is part of what's happening here is they're now encountering peoples outside of themselves, right? The Europeans are. Outside of them, new cultures, new kinds of people, new ways of living that they hadn't anticipated. And those encounters are challenging fundamental things that they thought that they assumed about the way the world operated and don't appear to operate in these new environments, right? So you can see where all of this is going, right? The principle I think that we're getting to is this principle, that all things are for the flourishing of all human beings, okay? That's the universal destination of goods. God intends by nature all things for all of us. All things, to put differently, are for the sake of the common good, right? And of course, there are discrete political common goods, and we argue in the Catholic tradition there's actually a universal common good, and that's a little bit more interesting. It's being challenged by some people today. Things of the world belong originally to nobody, are for the benefit of everybody, but they do get distributed by conventional means. Civil law does, in fact, specify, that's her notebook, that's her pen, this is my laptop, right? Civil law specifies those things, respects those things, it has the force of law, right? The coercive force of law, and so on. However, right, all of that is qualified, again, by the lexical and the chronological priority of the universal destination of all goods. In certain circumstances, in other words, in situations of need, the claims of the common good are actually going to qualify the claims of our private possession. Okay, or so I would argue, right? And I don't think this is not just me, but there are people who contest that too. So, a regime of private ownership does make sense given the fallen nature of human beings, okay? That regime of private ownership protects the native populations of the Americas when the Spaniards come in. Vittoria is among those theologians, and there are others who argue, these guys actually own this stuff. We do not have a right to come in and take it from them, okay? It actually works in that context to protect them against certain kinds of claims others will make. They're not, right, they're sinful. Or the more common claim for Catholics was they're violating the natural law, right? Their violations of the natural law are so egregious that they seem to be evacuating their claims on dominion. Vitoria rejects those claims. It does actually protect them, right? However, and this is like something that I think some of you guys are familiar with, in cases of necessity, things become communal again. Okay, they get reordered towards the communal, right? And this is Thomas Aquinas, Article 7. Things which are of human right cannot derogate from natural right or divine right. The human right here, right, is referring to more or less that civil agreement we reach about how things are going to be distributed. It's not like, it's not merely a civil claim. It's not merely a legal claim. It has more force than that. It's a claim more or less of natural right, but it's not that sort of first instance of the natural law. According to the natural order established by divine providence, inferior things are ordained for the purpose of succoring man's needs by their means. Wherefore, the division and appropriation of things which are based on human law do not preclude the fact that man's needs have to be remedied by means of these same very things. Hence, whatever certain people have in superabundance is due by natural law to the purpose of succoring the poor. Whatever we have in superabundance is due by natural law to the purpose of succoring the poor. This leads into his famous claim that, you know, some of you are familiar with about, is it theft in certain circumstances for somebody out of a grave need to take from someone who has superabundance? And I think everybody knows, Thomas says, in a situation like that, it may not in fact be theft, right? It may not in fact be theft for the person in a situation of grave need to be taking from somebody who has a superabundance of something, because that thing, in a way, is actually ordered towards the person in that kind of need, okay? And that's a provocative claim, right? It's a powerful claim against certain ways of understanding things, okay? So some of the newer things I wanted us to point to, right, that I didn't get to discuss, and I didn't want to go on for too long, is first, the way in which, like, I've discussed private property or private possession here in ways that might suggest it's individual, right? It's never understood in the tradition in that way. It's always conceived of as a social concept, okay? And it's a social concept in lots of different ways. One that I've talked about a lot is it's a concept of the social itself in terms of how we actually distribute things, in part responsive to your question, right? That these decisions are actually made in societies by people applying their reason, different ways that that reason gets applied and gets adjudicated in different kinds of societies, right? But that's an important way that this is the case. Second is when the tradition thinks about what a man, and it often thinks about a man, so apologies, right? I mean, generally speaking, these are older documents, but what a man is due by right or how we're supposed to understand his need and so on, the man is usually considered of as himself a social being, often as the father of a family, right? The head of a family. And, right, his needs then are sort of folded into the needs of that little community that he helps support. Secondly, and we did talk about this a little bit, would be just simply the ways in which our own laws, American laws, laws that we're familiar with, actually do or do not instantiate certain kinds of principles that we've been discussing today. Lots of Americans think of, you know, right, their private property rights as inviolable. We reflexively like to think nobody can come and take my this or that, but you also know, right, with 10 seconds of reflection, that's false. Right, there are lots of ways in which our property claims are in fact qualified by the claims of the common good. Right, the government will make certain kinds of claims on our property. Right, in taxation, right, in toll taking. Of course, eminent domain is one expression of this as well. Right, so there are lots of different ways and beyond this that the law actually speaks to certain of these insights about the way in which property or private possession is never simply a private ownership, right? It's something that's got social implications, political implications. And then there are ways in which we might say that we're deficient in thinking through those kinds of things, certain kinds of hesitations about stuff. And that really, in a way, leads to, I think, the immigration discussion. And this is something a little bit more provocative and a little bit less developed in my own thinking. But I do think that the way I described private property, it's ordering towards all, and then this notion nonetheless that there can be distribution in the world, the necessary distribution that's a consequence of sin, the way the distribution's actually worked out in any particular place at any particular time, right? And then the situations of those who are in need can actually help us perhaps think about immigration, right? Because immigration, those who are in and those who are out and those who are in need and those who have more, right, and so on, is more or less a kind of consequence of certain kinds of property claims that have been made historically over time. And I think even by analogy, you could say, like much more proximately or much more like circumstantially, that an immigrant might be that kind of person who is in such need that they make claims on us out of our superabundance that might actually attenuate our own capacity to say no, right? No for whatever reasons. No because, you know, we're worried about security, or no because we're worried about the way they might be draining, you know, certain of our, you know, resources and so on, right? So I think there's a kind of a neat in the sense of interesting possibility of exploring the way immigration questions might actually be related to some of these issues. And I think that that's partly why the Franciscan, the Victorian, the Spanish engagement with the peoples in the Americas might itself be instructive for thinking through some of those kinds of problems. So I'll leave that there. I hope I've raised some questions, and thank you very much for your attention. Yes?
Does Aquinas' contention about the okayness of stealing in cases of necessity account for the relativity of need? I mean, what constitutes a need, and is there any room for consent?
I'm not sure. Any room for consent by?
So, by the person who is being stolen from. I mean, is there any sense of accountability there? What constitutes a need in a scenario where stealing is okay?
Right. So the need there is that's a great question, right? I'm pretty sure what he means is a kind of sense of survival need, right? Not like we all know there is going to be a kind of plasticity or contextual nature to certain kinds of needs, right? I'll talk to my students all the time, and I'm sure, you know, you get this kind of question in your class. Like, is the internet a need, right? You know, and there are ways in which it is, right, for young men and women who are, like, trying to be students and excel in school and so on. If they don't have access to the internet, they are disadvantaged, right, in relationship to their peers and so on. But I don't think he's talking about that. I think he's talking much more basically about survival, right? Somebody who doesn't have shelter or doesn't have the most basic human needs, food, health, perhaps, right, which is provocative, satisfied, that they could have certain kinds of claims. Consent would sort of evacuate the sense in which it's theft at all, right? Theft has the quality of the non-consciousness of the person from whom something is taken, the hiddenness of it, right? I usually, like, I sneak into your house and grab one of your 15 loaves of bread or something like that, right? You don't know, right? Once you consent to it, hey, take my bread. Although I guess I'm thinking now of the Jean Valjean stuff, right? Like, you know, the Les Miserables stuff, right? There's a difference there, right? You know, and maybe even that scene, right, in the story indicates maybe the strength of your question, right? That at the point where I'm saying, hey, look, you know, actually I recognize that I don't need the bread. You take the bread, or you take the candelabra, whatever it is that's stolen, right? There's a kind of recognition that, yeah, this is in fact what you're due. It's a good question. Am I getting at it?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Other questions? Dr. Frey?
I just have a question about property and security.
Yeah.
So it's adjacent to the stuff about theft, but also immigration.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the most obvious kind of property right is sort of like, you know, land and
right.
Home.
And, right.
And so I recently had someone break into my home and steal some things from me, and I don't know whether I have super abundance, but I now don't feel safe. You know, like my sense of safety is gone. And I don't actually care about what they took, but it's my sense of safety that, and the safety of my children.
Right.
Which is, and I don't really see that in any of this conversation, right? The sense of, because why do people, why do people want property? You know, it's to protect themselves against people who want to harm them. And I just find it curious that this is, like, hasn't even come up.
Why do people want property? They want property to protect themselves. Well, maybe I'd put that differently, and maybe I'm wrong in putting it differently. So I think part of what, like, Thomas is getting at in that question, right, that about theft, is not about your apt concern about security, but about the way things may be distributed for whatever reason, right? The proper distribution of things. Okay, so if you're thinking theoretically about the proper distribution of things, right, we can recognize that sometimes the way things end up getting distributed, the way they actually end up getting distributed is completely unequal or unequal, right? So somebody has a whole bunch and somebody has very little, right? And he or she has so little that they're literally in danger of dying, you know, of starvation or by exposure to the elements and so on, right? And so we could say, well, that distribution is not itself just, which is what Thomas seems to be saying, right? That distribution is not, in fact, just. And when the other person comes and says, hey, wait a minute, that bread is actually in some way mine, right? Because it's just sitting there in superabundance. I'm actually making a justice claim that is intelligible. So that's, I think, that. You're asking the question, I think, which is not discussed right here, about security itself, right? And the way in which the laws that protect distributions of goods pertain to things beyond merely the distributions of goods, right? So Thomas is not saying, yeah, look, I'm in favor of people disregarding civil law, right, in order to redistribute goods. I think he's making just a general principle about sometimes the distribution of goods in a society will be itself unjust, right? We can address the injustice of the distribution of goods in societies in multiple ways. One is, out of my own desperate need, I'm just going to take it because I can't wait for the law to change, right? Another way to do it is, let's change the laws, right? So you don't have to worry about somebody coming in because that person might be better cared for or so on. But we do want laws still to protect your home, right? And protect that aspect of what it means to possess and hold something securely. No?
Well, I guess I'm just a little bit confused because, yeah, there's distributive justice. Fine. Like, if we're in the space of particular justice, there's distributive justice, but then there's rectificatory justice.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, theft, right, is one of those so-called one-way transactions, right, where it involves, you know, it's by force. So one party to the transaction.
Or guile. Force or guile, right?
Yeah, by force or by fraud or deception. You're taking my stuff. Now, that's not a voluntary transaction on my part.
Right.
And it may be that.
Maybe involuntary even.
Surely it is. And, like, look, maybe the only reason you're stealing from me is because, again, there's a lot of there is lacking distributive justice or something. But it still seems like you've stolen from me.
Mm-hmm.
And it still seems like, in some sense, you've wronged me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's the force of the question, right? And it's unclear how the fact that, you know, well, you know, but I am really hungry or something.
I may not have wronged you, though, Jennifer, right? I may not have wronged you.
Right,
you may have wronged me, right? You may have wronged me, right? Right? One possibility here that is certainly being advanced by Thomas and I think others in the tradition is you may have wronged me by the way the distribution of goods has been protected by, you know, either custom or a legal regime that is insensitive to the needs of some, right? So it's quite possible, you may wrong me, your particular, right, the thing you're describing, right, your sense of being violated and so on, which is real, right, can be understood as either a legitimate claim or an illegitimate claim, right? So I don't want to like get in caricatures of things, right? But the supremely wealthy person, right, who feels as though taxation, right, is a violation of, you know, his rights because, you know, he earned it or whatever, right, arguably is making a legitimate or an illegitimate claim, right? I mean, he's either saying something that's legit or not. And the person who's saying, no, wait a minute, I don't have anything, right, or I have very, very little, and you have so much you can't even spend or use it, right, is doing the same, right? These are all, like, potentially legitimate or illegitimate claims. And the way things are distributed in a society is a real thing. It operates with the force of law and so on. But everything I think the tradition is saying is, or that we've seen here, says it doesn't have to be that way, right? Sometimes this will be done in an unjust way, and sometimes in a more just way. And it can be challenged by the universal destination of goods. Somebody has a claim out of their need that this needs to be fixed, right? How do we fix it? Right, there are different kinds of, again, there are different ways of approaching it, aren't there? You want to respond to this, Kelly, right? I think.
So I had a question, and maybe it comes in with this.
Yeah.
Or like, so I guess, curiously, I was thinking, what if I'm like the would-be criminal, right? If I'm the thiever, right? Or the thief.
Yeah.
So one way we might think of it is, if, let's say I'm like a good Thomist who like fell on really bad times to the point that I've like justified in my mind to have to steal.
Right.
Steal, air quotes. And I'm walking down Saluda Avenue where Jennifer lives, and so I might actually, there might be a sort of double effect. It might be incumbent upon me as the thiever, like, oh my gosh, I shouldn't actually steal from this house because it's like a house full with a bunch of young kids. And this person's like a single bachelor,
yeah,
right? And there might be some sort of like responsibility on the thief to actually prudently steal, right? Because
right.
of potential, we could call it a psychological harm, right? So I think there is something about how maybe like, even though this distributively the rich person doesn't have a legitimate claim, perhaps we could go with that. But in as much as private property is associated with safety, and given our whatever the cultural historical circumstances at the time, such that like this is a greater psychological threat, like because it's so foreign to us in theory, like to
right,
have
right.
to deal with thieves breaking into our property, maybe in ways it's more common, so we're inured to it in other historical times. Such that the thief actually has some sort of responsibility. Now, whether or not they're like developed or like have the virtues to see this, but we could still say the thief, if it comes to the point of thieving, has a responsibility to thieve prudently.
Well, look, yeah, of course he does. I mean, of course, you know, everybody has a responsibility to act prudently, right? And prudently, both in the sense of the virtue of prudence, but prudently in the sense you're describing, right? More colloquially, like, he's supposed.
First
of all,
to steal doesn't mean I have the right to steal from this particular person.
That's right. Absolutely right. That's right. That's right. The claim is from someone's superabundance. It's only right. That's the operating principle here. Is more or less superabundance itself suggests, right, an unequal distribution of the goods that were intended for all, right? So I mean, Jennifer's right in a way. Like the old tradition is thinking much more in terms, generally speaking, of property, right, of land, right? And if you think about the classic circumstances that we're talking about here, we're talking about land lying fallow, right? People can't even use it, right? They have so much, they have, you know, thousands and thousands of acres, and you've got peasants who are working the land and so on, who have very limited access to it. They're not, often their own cultivation of the land for their own purposes is controlled by those who own the land and so on. Right, these are those kinds of situations in which this stuff comes up, right? So there is supposed to be, right, a normativity to the principle of superabundance, right, that's operating here. It's not just I'm walking down the street and I see, you know, Jennifer's preoccupied with three of her young children, right, and I'm going to go inside and steal the pie off of her, you know, her windowsill, right? It's not that. It's a principle about, I think, you know Thomas better than I do, like I would defer to you, like I don't think he's saying, hey, look, the guy walked down the street and he stole, right? I think he's instead using an example to show us the way in which in certain circumstances these two principles, the destination of goods and private possession, actually are functioning to help us understand when it's actually out of justice appropriate for somebody to take from somebody else who has too much, not from somebody who happens to have a pie, or whatever, who happens to have a little bit more or something like that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess I've always assumed that passage. By the way, I've literally never seen a pie in Jennifer's windowsill.
I've never seen her windowsill, so. Yeah.
But I mean, I guess I've taken that passage to have a kind of presumed background, some of which you just articulated.
Yeah.
But even outside of that particular kind of economic and social context,
right,
where there's fallow land and part of feeding might be just using it for my own purposes,
right,
which doesn't have the same kind of effect as breaking into somebody's house. I'm also following on from Kelly's point. I mean, if I'm in need, I also have a responsibility to try to satisfy that need in other ways prior to my stealing, for example, by asking.
Mm.
So there's a sense in which the person from whom I steal is not just kind of unconsciously or ignorantly complicit in my situation. Right? If I've asked properly, they may be more than that. Right? They may have refused aid, in other words.
Right,
in
right.
Some more direct manner.
Right. So it may not merely be non-voluntary. It might be right contrary to their will. Like, no, I'm not going to give it to you. Right? You don't work hard or whatever. You're the wrong kind of person for me to share this with or something. Possibly. Yeah, that might
I mean,
be right.
At the very least, it's not the case that I don't think, I mean, I could be wrong, of course, but I've never thought that Aquinas had in mind, well, I need something, this person's better off than I am, and so my first option is to steal. There are many, many other avenues towards satisfying my need that probably I have an obligation to attempt prior to theft.
I would probably agree that it's not, your first option is not theft. But theft does presuppose, again, the hiddenness of it, right? The idea that it's not in the open. It's, I'm doing this, right, in a way that's not known by the other person. I'm not.
Well, yeah, that's. I guess I'm on Jennifer's side here. I'm not sure that unless it's super abundance of the sort where I wouldn't even notice that it's gone. I'm not sure there's such a thing as hidden theft. There's such a thing as theft. Where the victim is not present, is not aware of it in the moment.
That's what I mean by that. Yeah, I'm sorry. I mean
that still has a kind of harm, and that Jennifer kind of articulated,
harm of security.
It's not just a property loss harm.
Right.
It's another kind of harm that I think she was getting at, and I think that's part of the reason why, in fact, theft is not your first option.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, real first here.
Well, I'm going on a different subject, so someone else wants to comment on that.
Did you want to go on the theft one, sir, in the front?
Oh, okay. I guess, yeah, just in terms
back
of talking about theft, we could say that, well, do I need stolen bread? Well, how do I know I need stolen bread if I haven't bothered asking for it?
Yeah.
Or, tried to get it through charitable means or something like that. If I've exhausted all those options and I somehow still don't have bread,
right,
well, then, maybe I do need to steal it, in which case, if somebody feels a little bit less secure and it's that or I die of starvation,
Yeah, look, and maybe I'm misunderstanding the question. There is a prudential calculus, I think, to go back to Kelly's point, right, that and I guess you all are suggesting, right, that has to occur. I think it's primarily about the distribution issue. It's not a civil law, like how does this undermine civil law issue, right? Because he's going to say in other places that we're not supposed to undermine civil law, right? That civil law has the weight of law, even laws that aren't laws, right, that are unjust laws still have the force of law behind them and because of that have a certain gravity to them. So, yeah, I think that that's
obtains here, right? I think it's much more just about the distribution issue.
First, a clarifying question. So if I understand you correctly, you know, private property is not a natural right of any sort, but rather more of something, more pragmatic institution.
It is a natural right. It's a natural right in a second sense, though, right? It's not a natural right in that, in a sort of first sense of the natural law. It's a secondary natural natural right. I mean, the language is, you know, the language, some of the things I read said, you know, this is a natural right.
As in it was created by human reason to mitigate default.
It's an apt addition of human reason to the natural law. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to the natural law. Right. And again, some people would say because of the fall, some might say no, not necessarily because of the fall, but nonetheless, it's still an apt addition by the use of human intellect, because that's the kind of beings we are.
All right.
Yeah.
And so, and this is just more clarifying, just to understand properly. So by the same logic, could one say like traffic laws or traffic regulations be a natural addition? Because, all right.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, for the sake of the common good, right? They're ordered towards the common good.
So, okay, here comes more of the actual question. So by that very idea, could one argue then that since in some ways it is societally derived, you know, just like traffic laws are, you know, societally derived in Nigeria, in France, in the United States differently, so that property would be different in different areas. And
yes.
Therefore, someone being in the United States would not be subject to the property laws, to the traffic laws of Nigeria or France or so forth.
Yeah.
Could one argue then that under that conception, one might not necessarily be violating property rights of native, and I'm not necessarily advocating
right.
this, but or that one would not necessarily be violating property rights of the natives, not but for any of the reasons like sinfulness or being insentient, but rather that one is not subject to the societal laws of the native kingdoms or whatnot.
Right, so we come in as Spaniards with different conceptions of possession than they have, and we say, hey, your conceptions of possession don't apply to us.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying? And because they don't apply to us, we can take your stuff or something like that? Or we don't understand you actually to own these things?
Basically, if these things are derived from society, if in some ways it's a societal law,
right.
derived from natural reason in addition to natural law.
Right.
Could one argue then that different societies have different, by different societies having different applications and understandings of those laws?
Yeah.
If one is not beholden to a society, then one is not beholden to their conceptions of private property. And thus, if the Spaniards do not understand them to have private property, they don't. At least something that.
Right.
Where
so,
am I wrong?
Well, it seems like I'm not. Yeah, I don't see how you get to that to the conclusion, right? So everything, like, so there clearly is distinction, right, about how societies own property or whether they own property, right? The ways that they divide up property and so on, right? So there are some cultures where people actually do have common possession. In fact, they're even within the Catholic Church, right? There are communities that own things in common and so on, right?
Yes.
Right. So the fact of disagreements about property laws or diversity with regard to property laws and distribution is incontestable, I think, right? That seems incontestable to me. Nonetheless, many of these peoples will still say, wait, these are ours, right? These things are ours. That river is ours, or that mine, you know, the gold mine is ours, or something. You might think it has to belong to, you know, Joe Capizzi, but we here think it belongs to the whole community, right? But I don't know how you get from that to now, well, the Spaniards can say, well, because we have a disagreement about this, we can override your understanding of this and make some claim to it or something. Am I misunderstanding there?
Maybe, I guess, the question at the core is it transcendent of civil society or is it confined to civil society?
The conceptions of property rights and
yeah.
so on? So, good question. So the fact of property rights, in a way it's a version of the question that this gentleman in the front asked earlier, right? The fact of property rights is more or less like of the jus gentium, right? It's of the natural law or, you know, it depends on how you understand the jus gentium itself to relate to the natural law. It's of the laws of peoples, the laws of nations, right? How the nations do that, however, is determined by them. So there is a supranational or supra-social understanding to it, right? In that, yeah, this is what human beings do, right? But the way it's done, there's less stake. That's less of the natural law. Much like that society, to go back to your example of the traffic stuff, right? That societies have ways of ordering the movements of their peoples is arguably like of the Jus Gentium, right? You know, they all do something like this, right? If you're going to have cars, you drive this way or that way, right? And you stop, or you have traffic circles or stoplights. Green means one thing, red means another. But that it means green means this in the United States, and it means, you know, go in the United States and stop somewhere else, right? There's no stake in that. There's no natural law like stake in that. But that you order the way people move, that you order the way property is demarcated and claimed and so on, is of the natural law. Yeah. So I don't know if I don't know how the Spaniards would get to make the claim. Kelly, you're the problem solver tonight.
Oh, I don't know. You might just say, look, that'd be kind of like saying, well, if I go to Britain, I'm an American, so I'm going to use American driving standards in Britain. And so we could presumably just say no. And then if we would have to say it's built into American specific laws that here's how America does it, and Americans by American law are able to do it how they want it, how they do it even in other areas. And that's where we just say, no, that's a misapplication of reason. If we think built into our human laws,
right,
we can say that,
right,
it transcends our political boundaries.
Right. Although we do have the obligation to follow traffic laws.
Right.
Right. We do have the obligation to follow traffic laws wherever they might be and whatever those might be. Right.
And I think that's why, like Francisco, right, so that was why the question with the natives came down to, like, should we consider this another political community? Because if,
right,
so, then we'd recognize we'd have to take their claims seriously.
Right.
If they're not, then we can just extend Spanish law.
That's right. Yeah.
So, I mean, a lot of this seems to be, like, about somebody-to-somebody interactions, right? Like,
yeah, that's what, almost like private.
Something.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, how do we extrapolate that to an issue then, like, immigration, where it's, like, it's not just a, is it just a somebody-to-a-somebody, or is it a state-to-a-somebody, and, like, how does that change the situation, I guess?
Yeah, like I said, like, right, there's a way in which discussing this, it sounds like it's very privatized, right, or very individualized, but it's really not, right? I mean, the examples and so on that are used by Thomas and that I pointed out, and the language that, you know, that we use can suggest it's a kind of privatized conception, but it's never that. It's much more social than that. So, I mean, the traffic laws is a nice analogy to this, that what we're thinking about is a way of ordering a community towards something, right? And it's towards ordered movement of people, it's towards ordered movement of property, it's towards stability and security and all of these kinds of things. And the immigration thing, right, is, on the one hand, it's a problem, because this is done at the national or social level, generally speaking, right? So you have American laws with regard to traffic, and British laws with regard to traffic, and Kenyan laws with regard to traffic. How do they relate to each other? Here you have American laws with regard to who's a citizen and who's not, and other countries' claims about who's a citizen and who's not. Everybody cares about citizenship. Everybody cares about political membership, right? The Catholic claim is, political membership is a great good, it's a stabilizing thing, it's an ordering thing, right? It's a good thing, but it's not everything, right? We, for lots of reasons, think that our membership in a political community is qualified, just like our ownership is, by other kinds of claims, by the ways in which the needs and concerns of other peoples outside of our political community might bear on this. This is the language of solidarity, right, in the Catholic tradition, right, which the popes are always saying, look, this involves the readiness, the steadfastness of will to think of somebody, you know, as not merely an other, but actually as your neighbor or your brother or your sister, right? And so just as we're supposed to think of our
fellow citizens as brothers and sisters and neighbors and so on, we're supposed to also think about those who are not fellow citizens in this way. So it has this supranational component to it, right, that makes porous in some ways the claims of the nation on us. And those will be porous in ways that other Christians might disagree with, right? Or even some Catholics might argue, you know, that I'm overreading. That, yeah, you want to follow up? Yeah.
So even, I mean, within a state then, like, there are plenty of billionaires in America, and can we consider that, one, a superabundance, and then two, like, is there a mandatory redistribution that needs to take place? Because that seems like a hot question, you know?
It is a hot question,
and
right?
And that's going to seem, I mean, that's...
It's a hot question, right? And one way to resolve it is certain kinds of very, you know, robust property claims. Like, look, it's theirs. They don't owe anybody anything. You're not in, you know, those of us who are non-billionaires, and I'm sure that's almost everybody in the room, right? We don't have situations of the kind of grave need that are discussed, you know, that Thomas is even considering, right? So distribution or distributive justice wouldn't be the lever by which you would argue against these kinds of things. You might argue by, this is what I, you know, the stability or security question. You might make a different kind of question. Look, it's not a question of distributing for the sake of my need. It's a distribution or a reuse of their funds, you know, their superabundance, for the sake of political stability or security. The fact of grave inequalities, this is an argument people are making now, right? That fact of inequality is destabilizing to a culture. It's not a situation where we're poor and therefore we need to redistribute. This is some people arguing this, right? Some might argue about the poverty. But a lot of people are saying, no, it's actually destabilizing. You know, it makes things less secure. People become envious. And envy and resentment, you know, and, right, that form of greed, right, those are facts of the human fall too, right? I think any prudential human calculus would have to take those into consideration and think about to what extent does that bear on a kind of pragmatic question about how we distribute funds in the country or, you know, so on. So I don't have, like, I'm not going to tell you how to vote. I'm not going to, you know, answer that question for you, but I think that this is exactly how to think about these kinds of things. You could think the poverty line too, right? You could just make, look, there are people in this country who are poor, right? There are people whose need is grave, you know, and there's a, to go back to an earlier question, there is a kind of contextual way, you know, to understand need, right? It's not, I'm not saying need is not objective, right? But there's also a way in which need is, you know, sort of deeply influenced by the social. And because of that, some, you know, you saw the argument the other night, right? How many houses do you have? Did you guys see, you know, the Bernie's got three houses, and Bernie responds, well, which tax haven do you call your home, right? Which is a great response, I thought, you know, like, right? That's a bizarre kind of argument to have for most of us, right? You know, this is literally what these guys who are running for the country are, you know, arguing about is how many houses they have or who's got more tax havens. And there are people who are poor by comparison to that. They're not poor like people, they may not be poor the way people have been poor in human history, right, or are in other parts of the world, but they can't make, you know, certain ends meet in the way that most of us take for granted, you know? And that could be itself a kind of argument for distribution. The argument for distribution, I think, is here. You know, some kind of argument about distribution is here, that it's a justice claim, right? It's built into this conception of private possession and its relationship with universal destination of goods. We have to think about it, is I guess what I'm saying. Other questions? Yeah. And then it fell over there again. Yeah.
This may pertain to the four criterion, which...
Vittoria?
Right. So just out of curiosity, then, would a person's body be considered private property?
Yeah, good question. Certainly people's bodies have been thought of as property in human history, right?
The draft.
Huh?
The draft.
Slavery. right? Right? You're right. I mean, literally the buying and selling of other human beings, right? And the production and reproduction of other human beings. In American history, right, we know this, the breeding of slaves was, you know, understood as the production of certain goods that would then be consumed by others, right? Because once the slave trade, except, you know, by law was prohibited in the United States, the majority source of new slaves was birth, right? In human history, bodies have been thought of as human bodies have been thought of as property. According to this account, you know, I'd say like almost like a kind of yes and no, right? There are ways in which we have a kind of possession of ourselves, but the possession of ourselves is a possession that's expressed by those qualities of the human being that make the human being a human being, exercise of free choice and intellect. But it's also qualified in the exact same way private possession was, which is, I don't have the kind of ownership over my body that most of us think we might have, or most of our culture thinks we might have, right? So if you think about the way, one of the things that I'm fascinated by is by tattooing, right? And tattooing, when I was a kid, right, my uncle, who had been in the Second World War, had a tattoo on his arm. Right, he was the only guy that I knew, you know, who had a tattoo, because, you know, he'd been in the he was an infantryman in the Second World War. He had a tattoo, and, you know, if you had talked about, you know, anybody else about it, was a little, not quite scandalous, but you knew he'd been in the military, right? He'd served in the war, you know, right? He had a tattoo, but if you talked about, well, should I get a tattoo or not, most people would say things like, well, you don't own your body, right? Like, you know, your body's a temple; it belongs to God, right? Like, you don't deface your body, right? And that was an intelligible claim, right? That, almost like an uncritically accepted claim. I don't own my body fully, right? God has a claim on my body, and it even like sort of goes to the level of whether I could, you know, put ink on me or not, right? It seems kind of quaint and silly. But that notion of God having a claim on our body is built into this account, right? So way back in the earlier slides when I said, look, we can't own things. Right, remember there, Thomas said there are two ways in which a thing can be owned, and the first way was God's ownership of it. That's not an ownership human beings have over things. That includes our ownership of ourselves. We don't have that. We don't have that kind of, you can call it mastery, or you could call it sovereignty even, right? Or the language maybe would be more like more current would be autonomy. We don't have that kind of autonomous, right, ownership of ourselves that we think we do. So, no. In that sense, yes, in the sense of, but I do have some self-mastery, right? I do, and that means not merely that I can direct myself towards choices that I understand to be good and the means that I understand to help me pursue those choices. It also means I'm responsible because of that activity, right? The very ownership of one man by another man meant that the other man was in some ways not responsible for his action, right? Which is why they couldn't testify, or slaves couldn't testify and so on, right? They weren't understood to be full agents. And this is why the institution was so paradoxical and self-contradictory. It was because we did want to understand them as responsible too, and they committed crimes, right? Yeah.
I just had one follow-up.
Yeah.
Then what about in the context of like a covenant of your body to someone else, like in matrimony and monogamy? Like,
right.
What about in that context?
You're giving certain kinds of claim rights over to the other person, right? But you're not giving unlimited claim rights to the other person. So there is an exchange, much as there would be of other property, but it's not an exchange that is complete, and it cannot be, right? Which is wonderfully freeing in some ways, right? That person could not do to you whatever he or she wanted by virtue of his or her own, you know, agency. Right, because you are claimed primordially by God, right? You are ordered towards something else than simply the satisfaction of the person with whom you have this covenant. On the other hand, it's real, right? You are giving your body to the other person in a way that involves your sexuality, right, and you know your health, right, and so on, right, potentially. I think it's a great thing to think through.
I think it implicates all this stuff.
He had a question.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Somebody over here?
Yeah. So are our property rights qualified by duties of stewardship to nature? So, like, do we have a duty to preserve, like, the beauty of nature?
I think so. So, again, it would be, in a way, be answered in the same way that I would answer that, right? Because, again, God has ultimate ownership, right? God has ownership in the complete sense, the full sense. And human beings are told, and we know by reason, we could argue, that what we owe in justice is always owed to God, right? So we owe God and each other. That there's a relationship of our right of justice to not merely, it's not merely a horizontal phenomenon, right? It's a phenomenon that also has a vertical component, what we owe to God. That's God's creation. He calls it good. We are a part of it. We are ordered towards it, right? It serves us in some respects, but it's not merely an instrumental good, right? God himself gets enjoyment or, right, labels as good his own creation before human beings come into being. So, yeah, I think as a component of justice fully understood, we're supposed to love his creation, including ourselves, in a way that shows love to him. And that wouldn't be by simply using things. Actually, the language in the tradition is abusus, right? Abuse. We have the capacity to enjoy it, fructus, right, is the language in the Latin, right? That is given to us, but we don't have a right of abuse over things. And abuse would be like to destroy it, right? A rich man, you know, who burns his money because, look, I'm so wealthy, I'm going to, you know, set fire to $100 bills or whatever, or, you know, take a bath in, you know, stuff because I'm just so wealthy and just destroy things, right? We don't have that right. That right has not been granted to us.
And in violating it, we are harming our relationship with God?
Yes.
Rather than another individual?
Both. Okay. Both. I mean, obviously, like, this is what Pope Francis argues, actually, quite well, right? That, and he's not the first pope to argue this, but you said, like, we're not merely violating God, are we violating other individuals? I mean, some of the other individuals we're violating have not yet been born, right? So when we're abusing God's creation and arguably, right, misusing it such that there's nothing or there's less left for those who might come after us, right? We're clearly violating God and we're violating each other. Yeah.
On the question of, you know, theft being permissible, or at least having a valid claim in the conditions of superabundance of the party being from which the theft is done and the necessity of the other, would the degree of necessary superabundance be conditioned on the necessity of the person? If, for example, a person was in dire, dire need,
right,
he needed food now or he'll die, is the degree of superabundance of the other person less than if someone's in a desperate strait, but, you know, they'll at least live a couple of days? You know, in
right,
the first instance,
right,
could someone steal bread for someone such that they'll, you know, they'll barely
right
live?
Good question, right? So in other words, is there like a scale? The greater your need, right, the lower the superabundance of the other person could go. I mean, look, to the point of, what was the philosophy professor? Not Jennifer, but the other
Michael Dixon.
Dr. Dixon. To his point, right? The first steps here would be recourse to other means by which you're trying to get your needs met, right? You know, you'd be looking for justice from other people in different ways than that. Aquinas doesn't suggest a kind of scalar, you know, aspect to this. I don't know. What would you do, right? Is if that's more or less what you're asking, or what would, you know, wherein does justice lie?
Well, I guess the question instead is that, you know, there is, how do I phrase it? So let's take two scenarios. You know, the first is
The need that provokes me to do this in the first place is grave itself, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, how grave is the grave need, right? Like, it's supposed to be right, a kind of survival, like I said earlier, like a kind of survival need, right?
And the question is, if it's like an absolute survival need, would the superabundance be in terms of survival for the other person? Would the superabundance be in, you know, they wouldn't notice it? Because if I, you know, just need to eat, am justified to take food from someone who has a superabundance, would the superabundance be this person, if I take this food, they'll live? Or this person, I'll take this food, and they shall not greatly notice it.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I don't think that superabundance is about them noticing it or not. You know, I didn't think that that was the issue. I don't think that that was the thieving issue. So I don't think that's the question. You know, I think it's they have more objectively than they could ever use. Right. And my need is not being met. Put differently, the universal destination of goods is violated by this distribution, right? That's the important thing here, right? And there's going to be plenty of violations of the universal destination of goods. Sometimes, however, I don't have grave need, but I may have less than you do, right? And you may still have a superabundance, but I don't have grave need.
Yeah.
Right, and there's possibly kind of violation of the distribution here, right? Ideally, it's supposed to be held in common, and so on. But when I have that grave need, that stuff is as though it's mine, right? My need actually makes a claim on it prior to my even taking it, mm-hmm. right? By justice, your superabundance, my need equals that's actually kind of mine, right? By law, it's not. By civil law, it's not. It's yours, right? That's why it's theft when I take it. Right, the law, or we might recognize afterwards, wow, you know, I mean, this was a kind of one-off, right? This is not a bad guy. This is a guy who was driven by his own need or something, and your obstinance, or you're not being available. You're not being available for whatever reason, right? His own need being urgent.
I guess the question is, what is superabundance? But in some ways,
it's a good question.
This answered more the question, you know, the question I have, which takes precedence, which it sounds
like. Look, the superabundance question is a great question, right? What is it, right? Because we mostly think in terms of money, mm-hmm. right? We don't think of, you know, bread, right, or something that's perishable, right? Like, you know, a stock room of apples or lamb or whatever, right? Like, it's not that. Most of us is about money, right? And superabundance of money, like, you know, how does that help me? Or how, you know, and that becomes a very different kind of, right? That changes, I think, the way all of this is thought about. You know, the different economic systems that are in place now as opposed to earlier is going to make this kind of question a different question, which is why it's phrased, I mean, it's why it's, you know, to your point earlier, Grace's point earlier, it's why the campaigns right now are the way they are, right? They're not about anything remotely like what we're discussing. They're about instead, should billionaires have billions of dollars, right? And if they shouldn't, number one, how do you get their money from them? And number two, well, right, that's a hard issue, right? A lot of that money's not in the United States. So how do you get the money from them? And then what do you do with it when you get it? You know, that's a different kind of question than the question that Thomas was entertaining, although it might still be implied by, or, you know, concern about it might be implied by the analysis that we looked at earlier. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Let's go back to Native Americans.
Yeah.
You talk about the Spaniards, but let's talk about North America.
Yeah.
Many Indians claim certain areas.
Yeah.
Were theirs because they fought for it. And they drove other people away.
Right.
And the Europeans come in. It's like, whoa. Go back to sinners.
Right.
Their whole ownership of the land was based upon physical prowess or whatever.
Right.
Okay, so then how does Aquinas approach this then? If their ownership was based upon their ability to conquer another nation or whatever, and then we come in and say, oh, well, we're just doing the same thing that you're doing. And you have so much. Look how much you have. All of North America. You don't need that much. You just need this little reservation over here.
So a big issue in all of this stuff, which I didn't get into at all, is the notion of a just title. Okay? And it's a really fascinating issue, right? So Blackstone talks about this in this quotation that I mentioned, right? The right to property is fascinating, but we're afraid of it because we all, he's speculating, are suspicious that the further back we look at why or how we became owners of something, we're going to find in there some defect in the title, right? We're going to learn that actually, you know, my great-grandfather actually stole in order to build the factory, you know, that now makes me super wealthy. Or that a country that lays claim or a tribe that lays claim to some land is going to find, you know what, we actually just exterminated the prior owners of it. Or we hoodwinked them out of it, right?
Right.
And as Blackstone knows, that problem exists, right? That problem exists. It's right. It you can't go back to an age of innocence, right? In property, very often, and particularly when you think in terms of the way nations come to make certain kinds of claims. Typically, it's a consequence of conflict, right? Some conflict occurred that now allows you to claim, what was it, Crimea recently, right? Remember, right?
Right,
that became a provocation for an intervention by the Russians recently. Or the Falklands, remember the Falklands, right? The just title issue, though, is not simply a national issue or a tribal issue. It's an issue about all property. And it relates, again, to slavery. One of the claims in the tradition for justifying slavery was there were, in fact, just ways by which to become enslaved. One of those, the biggest claim for this was being vanquished in war. You lose in war, by right the victor could claim you as a slave. And Augustine explains that this is the term in Latin for slave is servus, right? Which is the term that gives us preserve and conserve. And Augustine said, yeah, I mean, the etymology explains it because by right, he thinks, and the Romans thought, the victor had the right to exterminate the vanquished population, in particular their men, right? Their men and boys. Because that conduces to stability and peace, right? And servus was applied to them because out of magnanimity, instead of exterminating them, it would enslave the population. That was a just title by which one person becomes the owner of somebody else, or one group becomes the owner of another group. And others would be self-sale, right? You could sell your children into slavery. That's right, historically, right? And even today, still occurs in some parts of the world. It's a just title, recognized by the jus gentium, right? The laws of peoples all recognized that. So the language of titles is an important language that, I can't resolve the problem of what happened in Native, you know, both to the Native American tribes. None of them owned the North America, right? They owned, right, or they claimed certain territory, right, or a certain territorial rights, and they always were contesting each other about where those territorial rights were sort of centrally located and not, right? But, you know, we're having an argument in the United States now about this, or a conversation about this, the extent to which our claims are just or not, or the titles are defective and so on. New York State lost a judgment some years ago to a tribal population that claimed basically, right, that they had been, right, that New York had claimed land unjustly from them, and New York was too broke to pay them the compensation, right? You guys might know this, right, that New York gave them, gambling licenses, and also, you know, in perpetuity has, you know, granted them money, and right, casinos, right, and other things, right, as a kind of, oh yeah, you know, you were wrong. So our own, right, we actually, these things are decided to some extent in our court system. Our court system is engaging these kinds of questions. It's property. Part of the reason I find property interesting is because it's one window through which to look at very different types of problems that we deal with in morality or in thinking about living in society, you know? And you can see it. I mean, it relates to the conception of the human being, marital relations, right? It relates to children, understanding children. I mean, this is a huge issue in the United States now, right? Understanding children and what they are, whose they are, right? Divorce proceedings and so on, right? It's everywhere. And Jennifer and Dr. Dixon, is that his name? Point earlier, it also relates to issues of security, right? It's a nice thing to look through, and it dominates law. I mean, I always want to like say, do you guys ever hear The Redheaded Stranger by Willie Nelson? You guys know that album, right? You can't blame a man for killing a woman who tries to steal his horse. You know that it's a great law, but that's a property claim, right? And that was an old property claim, you know, that a man's horse or his gun, right, in the West was of such value that you could be killed by law for somebody, for taking somebody's gun or taking their horse. It seems so unintelligible to us now. It seems so brutal and wrong. But it's a nice way to look at the way a culture understands what's necessary to, you know, as a basic need, what's necessary for survival, and what are the apt punishments for certain kinds of crimes associated with it. Yeah.
Okay. Digressing.
I just digressed.
Another issue. The issue of abortion. This is my body.
Yeah.
This is my property.
Yeah, I took that to be implicated in part in her question before. Yeah. Yeah, look, so one way to look at that issue from what I've advanced would be to say, like, the abortion claim that says, look, this is my right, this is my body, et cetera, over this other, right, argumentatively, this other person, is it's a kind of slave claim, right? It's a kind of mastery claim, right? That I have such authority over this other human being, right? That I have literally the authority of life or death over this other human being. And that was, in its extreme, the kind of authority a slave could have over a master could have over his slave, right? My authority is so great, and your nothingness is so profound, that I actually have that kind of authority over you. So I think there's a really interesting analogy here between the kind of claim that has been made historically on behalf of slave ownership and the kind of claim that is made now. Now, partly this will be complicated by people saying, well, that's not a human being, right? Or, I mean, even, look, I know, right? Or even more problematically, right, self-evidently, a problem would be it's not the right kind of human being, right? Which is, I think, the claim that's sometimes made or is meant to be made, right? It's, yeah, of course it's a human being, but it's not the right kind of human being, which then you're like, yeah, that's exactly the slave claim, right? That's exactly the claim that was made in the past, right? Which is, okay, we know it's a human being, right? But he's not the right kind of human being. He's black skin, therefore we assume he's not, his reason is not as full as our reason is, and this is like, well, you know, it's developing, you know, or it's dependent upon the mother or something, right? And then it becomes, oh my gosh, right, like really eerily analogous to it. So I think other people have drawn that connection. This is not novel to me, but I think that's a really strong connection to make. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Capizzi. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah,